You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniele Friberincini.
Hello. The Giro is approaching.
Hello.
Evidently.
It is. So, yeah. So you assume your Italian identity, Daniel. Well, this is our penultimate episode before our Giro begins, isn't it?
It is. It is. We're packing our metaphorical bags, aren't we?
Yep, we're packing our metaphorical bags. We're painting ourselves pink. Can we put a bit of meat on the bones of our Giro? Because we obviously took a decision several weeks ago that we would do an alternative Giro when the Giro should have been on. And you've been beavering away on this, Daniel, coming up with a route and so on. But it's going to be pretty multifaceted, isn't it, our Giro?
Well, it is. It's going to be very interactive. I think we can exclusively reveal that it's going to be the opportunity to ride our Giro as well as listen to our Giro. We are partnering up with Road Grand Tours, which is a digital platform. We've obviously, like everyone else, become very au fait with the world of e-cycling over the last few weeks, and Road Grand Tours have offered us and are going to offer our listeners the chance to ride our Giro. So our Giro, we've redacted what would have been the route of the 2020 Giro, airbrushed it. I've made a few tweaks, and we thought that the full stages, so 220, 240 kilometers over the Dolomites, might be a bit long on a turbo trainer. So part of our Giro route is going to be available to ride every day, and lining up for the cycling podcast, I believe, are going to be Lionel Burney and the Lion of, what is it, Lion? What is it, Napalm? The Lion of the Chilterns? Is that it?
Yeah, that'll do. That'll do. I'll take that.
The Buffalo of the Borders. He's not really the Borders. Edinburgh is a bit further north than the Borders, isn't it, Rich? But what will be your avatar?
The Buffalo of the Dolomites here, I think, Daniel.
Not sure about I'll that. The be, Buffalo of the Trossachs, perhaps.
That goes well. I mean, we are going to be doing our bit. You seem to have left your name off the team sheet there for
the cycling
part.
If you can get me a bike. If you can get me a bike.
Funny that. Are you the DS then, Daniel?
Very much the race director, DS, doping doctor, possibly.
Wow. Are the courses going to be fairly marked? You know, we're not signing up to ride 30 kilometres and then going to find that it's actually 55 kilometres or anything like that. You're not channeling your inner Vincenzo Torriani, are you?
No, Napalm. All very accurately marked, logged using the latest technology. We're also partnering with VeloViewer. VeloViewer are the sort of map provider of choice for World Tour teams nowadays, and we are using their fantastic technology as well. So there's going to be more information about this next week, how you access the routes, how you access the maps. You can really geek out on all of that stuff. So it's all pretty exciting.
But we have to say,
We should just say that to ride our virtual Giro on RGT will be free, won't it? So anyone with a turbo trainer, smart turbo and a computer will be able to take part if they would like to join us.
Yeah, and we should say, obviously, there's a lot more to our Giro coverage and our Giro than
just you
and me, Lionel, sweating away.
Mincing about.
30 kilometre segments of the route. But we're hoping to organise sort of group rides and perhaps races as well. That's to be confirmed. But we're obviously telling stories as well about Giri, old and quite recent. I mean, we're going right back into the vaults, aren't we, of our coverage, but also telling stories about Giri of old with Fausto Coppi, not with Fausto Coppi, obviously, and Gino Bartoli, and then some of the more recent stories, you know, from the 2018 Giro, Chris Froome's win there, and Andy Hampson's win back in the 80s. We've got lots of fresh interviews with stars of old and more recent days, and so we're telling a whole lot of stories from the Giro.
Lots of familiar figures, lots of familiar voices from Giri of yore, cycling podcast Giri of yore. So, you know, you're going to hear Gianni Savio. Well, we heard Gianni Savio at the weekend, didn't we? Gianni Savio put on a fantastic performance with his wife. It was the day of the liberation, the anniversary of the Italian liberation from the Nazis, and this is celebrated in Italy with the song Bella Ciao traditionally, and there was a bit of a flash mob, I think, outside Gianni's abode in Turin, and not only did Gianni participate, but he filmed it for us, partly because the previous day I'd been speaking to Gianni, I'd been trying to get him to sing a song, perform for us for our Giro coverage, and he was a bit sheepish, but I got a message on Saturday which really brightened up my weekend.
You posted it last night on the Cycling Podcast Twitter account. It's on Instagram and Facebook as well. And I think it's brightened up the day for a lot of people. It was just very comforting almost to see Gianni there in his trademark dark T-shirt with a light blue shirt and jacket. And no doubt trainers as well.
Indeed, Rich, and there's going to be other features, some fantastic features we're going to have. There's going to be food, there's going to be wine, there are going to be all the elements that everyone is, well, hopefully familiar with from our Giro coverage in the past. So, we're very much looking forward to it and, you know, we're getting geared up.
Is there any progress on the wine, Daniel? My wine hasn't arrived yet. I don't want to fret, but it's not arrived. My Giro wine.
Mine has. That's the main thing. And my tasting notes are incomparable.
I think there are certain levies that have to be applied to wines when they exit the M25 line and when they get into the sort of, you know, the Watford hinterland. And I think that's
quite right.
What's holding that up at the moment?
We're not wine drinkers out here, really. Usually, you know.
No, it's more flat ale, isn't it? Anyway, that's all exciting and much to look forward to, and there'll be more details next week, and maps and graphics and so on, and there'll be the familiar Amara Terra music and voices, and also something we did last year which we're going to repeat this year, Stacey Snyder's mugs and cappuccino cups will be on sale, raising money for a very special good cause this time. We decided to ask Marco Pinotti, who we had on the podcast a few weeks ago and who lives in Bergamo or just outside Bergamo, to suggest a local good cause, because Bergamo has obviously been very badly hit by coronavirus, and a good cause related to cycling. So we'll reveal the good cause next week, but we're very excited and pleased that Marco has managed to help us with that. We'll hear from him in next week's episode and give you details about how you can buy one of Stacey's lovely mugs or cappuccino cups. Well, the Giro is coming up, or our Giro is coming up. Before that, in this week's episode, we're going to be looking back at the first year of Team Ineos. It was a year ago that Ineos took over from Sky as the sponsor of what is now Team Ineos. We'll talk a bit about that. We'll also hear from the team principal, Dave Brailsford. We've got quite a long interview with him about Ineos and about what's happening now in the lockdown situation and how they're managing that. And we'll hear also from Larry Warbass towards the end when we talk about all the aspects of the coronavirus crisis and how that's affecting professional cycling. We'll also hear from our fellow journalist Herbie Sykes towards the end of the episode.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk, iwoca.co.uk.
We're very pleased to be sponsored by iWalker, who specialise in lending to small businesses. They can lend between £1,000 and £200,000. Applications can take only a few minutes, and they promise a fast and fair decision. To find out more, let's hear from iWalker's Chief Operating Officer.
Hi, I'm Seema, and I'm the Chief Operations Officer at iWalker. We provide flexible finance to small businesses in the UK and in Germany. So our customers range from their hairdressers, plumbers, lots of the kind of high street services or kind of small business services that you that you might use yourself. We've been going for about 8 years now. So there's a team of around 50 people for the UK who are talking to our customers to help them complete their application, to help them withdraw funds, and to help them with their iWaka loan as their customers. Our mission is to provide the finance that small businesses really need, and we exist to help small businesses to thrive. And that mission hasn't changed. It's just got a lot harder. We're still there for our customers, and we want to help every way we can. And there's quite a few kind of pivots that we've had to make in order to do that within the current climate.
That was iWaka's Chief Operating Officer, Seema Desai. And in these very challenging times for businesses large and small, if iWaka sounds like the perfect fit for your small business, go to iwaka.co.uk. That's iwoca.co.uk.
We've only just begun to leave white lace and promises. Kiss for luck and we're on our way. Before the rising sun, we fly. So many roads to choose. We start off walking and learn to run. And yes, we've just begun. Sharing horizons that are new to us. Watching the signs along the way. Talking it over, just the two of us. Working together day by day. Together. And when the evening comes, we smile. So much of life ahead. We find a place where there's room to grow. Yes, we've just begun. Sharing horizons that are new to us. Watching the signs along the way. Talking it over, just the two of us. Working together, day by day. Together. And when the evening comes, we smile. So much of life ahead. We'll find a place where there's room to grow. And yes, we've just begun. And yes, we've just begun. And yes, we've just begun.
Well, guys, I don't know why I thought it was a fitting song for the first year of Team Ineos. You might have thought that they've only just finished because after the the great streak of victories by Team Sky. And now Team Ineos, and they're on a run. But in a way, my impression was that the last year for Ineos was kind of a new start with a new generation coming up with Egan Bernal replacing maybe gradually or not Chris Froome and Geraint Thomas. So there's probably a new start for the team, and so yeah, in many ways they've only just begun. And as we know, the last season has been quite a tragic and dramatic one for Team Ineos. With we know that Sir Dave Preston has not been well, and his health improved, and then obviously Chris Froome and his dreadful accident, and to talk to top it all, if I dare say, I mean, we lost Nicolas Portal, and I wanted to sing kind of a promising song, kind of not a happy song, but a hopeful song for Team Ineos, even though I'm not a great fan of Team Ineos. I mean, it's not the point, but I was a great, I mean, like all of us, I was totally shocked by the loss of Nicolas. Whatever you thought, or I might have thought of Team Sky and Team Ineos at times, Nicolas Portal has always been just a wonderful guy, just a great guy. He was always available, always nice, always explaining things calmly, quietly, always very articulate, very, well, just a dream of a guy. And we lost him, which is, of course, tragic, but the way he was, I remember once, it was in spring before the start of a season, like 3 or 4 years ago, I was writing a story for a magazine on French cycling managers coming up all over the place. You had him, you had Philippe Mauduit, and we talked for like two hours, and he was so keen, so enthusiastic about cycling, about his passion, and about conveying his passion to other people, talking about it to almost total strangers. It was such a and I'm sure the way he was, and the positive way he was thinking all the time, and his love for others and his love for cycling, well, I think deserved not a sad song, but kind of a hopeful one. So all the best for the future of Team Ineos, because once again, and all the best for the future of cycling, because oddly enough, with the crisis we're going through, there's been lots of talk about cycling maybe starting again from scratch and beginning anew. I'm an old, cynical Frenchman, so I don't think it'll happen, or maybe not as much as we would hope for it to happen. But yeah, it would be a good song for cycling as well. We've only just begun. Okay, guys, I've been a little bit long talking, but I hope you enjoyed it, and cheers.
Lovely to hear from Francois Thomazeau again, and his weekly song has become a real highlight of this period. And after a beautiful rendition of We've Only Just Begun, he paid a little tribute there to Nicolas Portal, the Team Ineos sports director, who died, of course, just before this lockdown period began. And it would have been his 41st birthday last week. A terrible tragedy, and one that, events have been coming so thick and fast that it's kind of easy to forget that was also a catalyst for Team Ineos pulling out of Paris-Nice and withdrawing from racing for a period as they came to terms with the loss of Portal. But we said earlier that, and we're going to hear from Dave Brailsford later on, but Daniel, you were noting last week that it's been a year since Ineos took over from Team Sky. And I guess, what have we learned in that year, and have they done what they set out to do, or do they look to be on track to achieve what they set out to do when the sponsorship was announced a year ago?
Well, you're right, Rich. It was a year. It was May the 1st when I think, were we all there? I was certainly there at the secret location at the time in Yorkshire.
You were there.
I had a little pub in Yorkshire. You'll remember a lot of the noise and the speculation about some protests because of Ineos's activities, plastics and fracking. There was talk of environmental protests and this affecting the launch. So they decided to hold quite an intimate gathering at a pub at what had been a secret location in Yorkshire. And it's quite instructive to go back and just look at what the new owner of the team, effectively Jim Ratcliffe, said, and what Dave Brailsford said, what their goals were a year ago. And we talked then about it possibly being a sort of vanity project, in the sense that Ineos were not a company that was necessarily necessarily looking for a lot of publicity. You know, there were allegations, there were suggestions that this was a greenwashing exercise. Well, you know, you could have even argued at the time that it would have been more effective not to attract any more attention to the company's activities, you know, the questionable activities. So it didn't really sound as though that was why they were getting into the sport either. And, you know, Ratcliffe said at that launch event that there was no harm, and were the words he used, in dedicating a modest amount of money to very worthy sporting endeavours. And what we knew about Jim Ratcliffe was that he was a very passionate sportsman, amateur sportsman himself. He'd got very into cycling, into running. He was also a big football fan. So it seemed as though this was something that he could pretty much do with Ineos's pocket money. So the goal, for, certainly as far as he was concerned, was not that clear. It wasn't in, you know, there were no sort of grandiose statements of intent in the way that there had been when Sky launched in 2010 about winning the Tour de France with a British rider. Nothing really like that. It was more of the same, I suppose. And Brailsford said the sport's not standing still. It's getting a lot better very quickly at the moment, and we have to work hard to keep ahead of the curve. So, you know, if we think about it in those terms, and, you know, this idea that maybe it was a bit of a vanity project for Jim Ratcliffe, I suppose the whole idea now in this sort of coronavirus crisis, that such a thing will exist still, that there will still be companies rich enough to just sort of go out and almost on a whim spend money on sports sponsorship, even that itself might have to be reevaluated now. Or that's certainly what I was saying to myself when we were thinking about this year anniversary. But then, you know, you look at the figures and you look at how much Ineos make a year, and the figure that Jim Ratcliffe quoted a year ago was £5 to £7 billion profit a year, and a team budget of, we think, around £40 million for Ineos is less than 1% of that. You know, I think they can still afford it. I think you're pretty safe to say.
You would think that it's one of the more stable teams out there, the more stable sponsorships out there, certainly. But, you know, I guess we, in looking at last year, and if you're looking at it purely from a results point of view, they won the Tour de France, of course, and it sounds ridiculous to say it, but they had a lot of bad luck, and Francois talked about it. You know, the you know, Chris Froome obviously, and his terrible crash. You know, even Geraint Thomas has kind of disrupted build up to the Tour de France last year as well with his crash in Switzerland. It didn't necessarily all go their own way last year, and they won the Tour de France. But apart from that, aside from that, they were quite anonymous in a lot of races, and especially the one-day races and the classics. And I was at opening weekend this year, which seems like another lifetime ago, but it was only really a few weeks ago, Het Nieuwsblad and Kerner Brussels Kerner, and they seem to be going in there with an awful lot of ambition to really, you know, address their failings last year, and really didn't. You know, they had another very disappointing weekend, kind of topped off by Gianni Moscon's problems once again when he was disqualified from Kerner Brussels Kerner for you know, throwing his bike at another rider after crashing. So it didn't look all that promising, the results from the opening weekend, in terms of how they might have fared in the classics this year.
You mentioned the Spring Classics, or the start of the Spring Classics opening weekend this year, Rich, but just looking back at some of the sort of notable positives and negatives of the last year. I mean, Carapaz and Amador arriving this year, they were two riders, well, particularly Carapaz, who you thought could possibly, you know, start to put a new stamp on the team. You know, he was going to be very much part of the new era for Ineos. We think maybe they'll have a slightly more Latin American leaning over the next few years with Bernal and Carapaz. But he obviously hasn't got going yet. Froome had his dreadful accident at the Dauphiné last year. He's obviously not ridden since then. So I think, you know, there have been a few factors really that have
that have slowed or obstructed this transition, this natural changing of the guard, which is going to have to take place from moving from Froome, Thomas, that era, or and you know, the Sky era, to Ineos with different leaders. But you know, that's probably not, that was never going to be an overnight transition. And you know, these issues that have intervened, so Froome's injury and now the coronavirus crisis, might have even made that process a little bit more complicated. Other negatives: Kwiatkowski had a bad year last year by his own estimation, and you know, looked as though he wasn't really enjoying his racing, and he's someone that they need to, well, they need to recover, and they need to get him back to how he was racing a few years ago. And they had a fairly mixed Giro and Vuelta last year. They were without notable leaders in those two races, and they didn't really go according to plan. So it's been a bit of a mixed bag. Some positives as well. Pavel Sivakov has kind of been overshadowed to a certain extent by other prodigies in the sport over the last year, but he won the Tour of Poland last year. He finished ninth in the Giro. He was fourth in the Tour of Britain. So in every stage race he's done, he's been outstanding, really. Ganna, I'm obviously not the most qualified pundit to evaluate his achievements on the track, but I'm led to believe that what he did in the individual
pursuit,
quite impressive. Ivan Sosa, there was a lot of hype about him when he joined the team. He followed pretty much the same path as Bernal, came from Gianni Savio's team. He won the Tour of Burgos. He's still only 22, so that was a positive. Eddie Dunbar has been developing very well, I think. Again, maybe not noticed by everyone or to a great extent internationally, but I think he's sort of shaping up to be a really strong rider for them. So yeah, it's been ups and downs.
I think one aspect that's interesting about the portfolio of sports interests that Ratcliffe is building up, and we don't know whether he's going to add to these things once the coronavirus crisis subsides, but you know, the cycling team offers a lot of bang for buck, doesn't it? It's relatively cheap in the grand scheme of things when you think that the Ratcliffe basically bought Nice Football Club, although the figures have not been confirmed by Ineos or Ratcliffe. The reported purchase price of Nice Football Club was €100 million. That is a significant investment. Nice now wear the Ineos logo on their shirts, and well, Ratcliffe had been linked with Chelsea as well, which would be another level of investment just to buy a club of that size and stature. But Nice offers a kind of an easy route, or an easier route into sort of Champions League type riches in the French league. You know, there's really Paris Saint-Germain way out in front, and then Nice, kind of a group of teams that could earn their way into the Champions League and start making a return on that investment. Whereas the cycling team doesn't really offer any kind of revenue beyond just the exposure of the Ineos brand. But in the grand scheme of things, it's very, very cheap. I mean, when you think that, you know, even the likes of Chris Froome and Geraint Thomas's salaries, which will be at the top end, I mean, they fit into the sort of annual salaries that you'd expect a kind of mid-table Premier League team to be paying to their sort of squad members. You know, it's really the wealth in football is so vast. And whilst there's a lot of criticism of, you know, people buying their way into cycling and distorting the market, and that was one of the worries a year ago, was that, you know, Ineos could just blow everybody out of the water, and they certainly could if they match the sort of investment that they've made in just in Nice Football Club. You know, they could completely distort the salary market in cycling. And so it's going to be really interesting as the sport emerges from the coronavirus crisis. You know, it's already a sport of haves and have-nots, and that could be really magnified. That disparity between the top and the bottom could be really magnified when we come out of this.
Well, in part one of Mind You with Dave Brailsford, I asked him a bit about that anniversary and about the different culture Ineos compared to when it was Team Sky. We just realised it's exactly a year since Ineos took over or were announced as the new sponsor. I don't know if you realised that.
No, I didn't actually. Not with everything else going on. Really.
There's quite a lot going on. Yeah. And I suppose it's a strange time to reflect on that, but how do you reflect on that sponsorship a year in?
I think there's the I guess in many respects there's it's been a very, very a much more dynamic year than it had been previously, because obviously, you know, Sky had become a well-oiled kind of operation. It was stable pretty much and consistent, and of course we had our, you know, ups and downs along the way, but the relationships were well established, and you know, people knew how the whole operation worked. So to change into a new operation, which is night and day from how Sky operates, then I think that was exciting, and also think it was refreshing, and it was like a breath of fresh air, really. And I think when you consider that pretty much, well, very soon after starting racing as INEOS, we also picked up and started working on the 159 project as well, simultaneously. That became a very, you know, dynamic situation to be in very quickly. And I think that gave us a lot of input and connection, if you like, with the with Jim and his team through the 159 project as much as through the cycling project. So I think we had a, you know, if you think about the normal levels of contact and communication, get to know people, I think that was accelerated massively through the added involvement of 159. And it was very exciting, and I think it's kind of been very much the same ever since. You know, they're a very, very dynamic organization, you know, very, very agile. And
is that because there's basically one man in charge?
Well, there's INCAP, basically, which is Jim himself, and then John Rees and Andy Curry, who are the three owners. They own INCAP, and so between the three of them, they've got total decision making authority. And there's no committees, there's no stock market, there's no boards, or you know, any kind of red tape. They basically have this incredibly efficient way of operating. They run the business in a federal kind of model, where each federation or business unit or business has its own, you know, governor, as it were, which is the CEO, and they report in, and they have ExCos, which is their executive committee meetings, where each of the chief execs go in, do their ExCos, and the INCAP guys are really skilled. I mean, really, really skilled at running, you know, these short, dynamic updates, and we do the same in sport. And of course, in the time that we've been involved, you know, the football team was, you know, OGC Nice was came on board. They had Lausanne already. The connection with the Formula One team was built. You know, Ben and his sailing team were already in it. So, you know, very, very quickly, INEOS has become a global force in sport, really. And within that organisation now, within INEOS Sport, it's got to be one of the most exciting places to be in a world of sport at the minute, because you've got so many different teams and skills and, you know, different abilities. And we can all, you know, cross-pollinate and share ideas, etc., between one another, whilst also focusing on our own teams. It's just a brilliant place to be at the minute. And
you've said to me in the last couple of weeks that, you know, that the company has sort of shifted again in response to coronavirus, and it's kind of you know, being able to respond to that as well. And I think you've been quite involved in that too.
Yeah, so they as the coronavirus came up, you know, Jim reckoned, they recognised that they made all the raw materials to make hand sanitizer, so they sat and created the challenge of creating a production line to produce hand sanitizer within 10 days, and get it up to 1 million bottles a month, and make sure that they're getting them to the front line free of charge, into hospitals, into the health frontline workers. And they did that in France, Germany, and the UK, and two lines in France, and one in Germany, one in the UK. And they asked, you know, we said, look, you know, if we're not racing, we want something to do, we want to work. And he phoned up and said, right, I've got a project, got a plan, we're going to do this, could you guys look after the distribution into the healthcare and the hospital sector, basically, for all the free of charge hand sanitizer that's going to go in there. So we grasped that with, you know, it was great, really. It's very dynamic, it's a new project, you know.
You grasped that with very clean hands.
I was just going to say that, stopped myself, yeah. and off we went and got involved, and now they're shipping out to hospitals in, so we're doing the UK, France, Belgium, Germany, and it's all going, you know, it's very dynamic, it's fast, and they've got rigor, they're not reckless, you know. They're very, 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 very inspiring to see the sort of entrepreneurial, the ambition and the level of thinking, and this kind of, you know, thinking beyond the immediate barriers that you can see to get things done, and pushing people forward with that. Certainly from my point of view. But if you ask what the difference is between Sky and INEOS, you know, Sky is a big corporate organisation, and the way that Jeremy Darroch ran the organisation and the way they ran things there was first class. I mean, a brilliant, brilliant organisation. But equally, INEOS is a brilliant organisation, just run in a very, very different way, which is much more dynamic and much more entrepreneurial, I'd say, in the way that they do things, and fast. And how they stay across everything, the magnitude, the scale of their business, and how they stay across it all is just phenomenal. And that's been a real education watching that. It really has. You know, I think I've learned a lot, I would say, from being with INEOS in the last 12 months. In fact, if you ask me what the biggest difference, you know, what's the biggest thing to come out of this on a personal level, I would say I have learned an enormous amount in the last 12 months from watching how these and learning from how these guys operate.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet interrupting this week's episode to remind me to tell you that it is sponsored by LACA. LACA is a community of cyclists working together to insure their bikes and equipment in the event of damage or loss, and ensuring that the premiums are lower and the payouts in the event of a claim are swifter. LACA will not be fazed by expensive bikes or fancy kit. The premium that you pay every month goes up and down according to other claims, but there is an upper limit. If this sounds like the kind of insurance you'd like for your bikes and equipment, go to laca.co.uk. But don't take our word for it, let's hear from a satisfied customer.
I'm Theodora, I live in Dalston in London, and I started cycling competitively this year, so I did my first crit races in January. I got my road bike in September, and it's the most expensive thing I've ever owned, so I thought I should probably get it insured. At the beginning of March, when we were still able to do fun things, I went down to Preston Park to do a crit there, and I was definitely winning, you know. But on the last lap, someone caught my wheel and I managed to skid into the fence and crash. And luckily, I wasn't too badly injured, cut some bruises, no concussion, but the bike, the front wheel had been completely mangled, the handlebars bent round. There was green paint from the fence all along the frame of the bike. I was very lucky. I contacted LACA on the following Monday, explained what had happened. They arranged for someone to come and pick up the bike. I was quite worried because it was a carbon frame and you can't necessarily see if the frame is damaged until it collapses on you mid-ride. But LACA had arranged, that after someone checked it, they arranged for the frame to be checked fully, and then they arranged for me to get a completely new frame and bike set. They even went as far as to go to the original bike fitter who'd set me up. So not only did I get a new bike, but it was completely set up to my original fitting and specifications around gearing.
So if that sounds like the kind of insurance that you'd like for your bikes and equipment, go to laca.co.uk. New customers can get £10 off their LACA insurance. When you go to laca.co.uk, use the code PODCAST, and it's laka.co.uk. cycling.co.uk. Well, before the break there, we heard part one of our interview with Dave Brailsford, really talking about the culture at INEOS and how much he's learned in what is a very different type of organisation. And, well, I guess it chimes with some of what you were saying, Daniel, about the cycling team and the sporting empire that's being built up, being a kind of a hobby, a project that clearly excites Jim Radcliffe. It's not really for a commercial return for a company like INEOS. Brailsford mentioning too that at the moment they've been able to shift some of their business to creating, producing hand sanitizers and distributing them around Europe. So you have the impression of just this enormous and extremely wealthy organization that's pretty nimble as well.
Yeah, I think what we get from that interview, or what Dave Brailsford said there, is that it looks very different from the inside, from where he's sitting. I suppose another question is how different INEOS looks from Sky to the outside observer, to the fan, or to the commentator. And I suppose that's a little bit of a moot point. I mean, we've talked before about the kind of branding of Team Sky and how it almost fed into this slightly robotic, if you were going to be harsh, you might say joyless image that they had, certainly in the eyes of some people. And, you know, it was quite interesting when on the 1st of May last year we saw the new jersey unveiled, and, you know, it was black. And you know, the image of the team hasn't completely pivoted, I don't think. You might say it's still a little bit sort of austere. And we also don't know how much they wanted to really escape the image of Team Sky, escape the legacy of Team Sky, or was it more of the same? Did they just want to build on something which they certainly believe in? And, you know, rightfully so, if you judge it purely on results, is one of the great sports franchises in terms of pure numbers and successes, and, you know, the number of Tours de France that they've managed to win. But, you know, it's going to be a question that's going to accompany this team throughout their lifespan, isn't it? How much have they been able to affect sort of hearts and minds? What's their legacy in people's affections? And, you know, we live at this sort of interface of different groups of fans. You know, we are exposed to, you know, real experts, people who follow the sport very, very closely, who have maybe over the years taken a slightly dimmer view of Team Sky. And on the other hand, we also, you know, occasionally come into contact with a more general audience, who, there's no doubt, Team Sky, you know, did sort of earn and win the affections of over the years. You know, a newer audience, maybe the kind of people that only watch cycling once a year, or they're mainly focused on the Tour de France. And you know, what we've always heard from them has been quite different from maybe what we've heard from regular listeners. And, you know, we don't know how prominent that is in the team's considerations, you know, the need to bridge that gap. You know, is that a goal of theirs? I don't know.
One thing about legacy, Daniel, is there's been an interview by Matt Dickinson in The Times with Chris Froome this week, in which he's obviously asked about how his comeback is going after last year's terrible crash at the Dauphiné, which of course ruled him out of the Tour de France. And, well, until the coronavirus crisis hit, we weren't sure, you know, where exactly Froome's recovery was, whether it was on track for him to be competitive for the Tour de France had it started on schedule in late June. He says in that interview that coming back and winning the Tour for a fifth time would be massive. It would definitely be one of the biggest comeback stories in sport. And when I read that, I just thought, that's the kind of thing that other people are supposed to say about you, isn't it? You know, you don't really cast your comeback as one of the biggest comeback stories in sport yourself. Maybe that's just me. I don't know. But there's kind of, You don't write your own legacy, do you?
Yeah, you don't know how the question was framed. Yeah, but maybe he was asked, would it be one of the biggest comebacks of sport, to which he said yes. You don't know how the question was framed, I suppose.
Although it is written as a direct quote. I mean, so you'd hope that it was those words came out of Chris Froome's mouth rather than it being agreeing to a statement that's been put to him. But it's interesting you mentioned legacy, because obviously, you know, the run of Tour de France victories are broken only by Vincenzo Nibali's win in 2014, when Froome crashed out before the race had reached the cobbles, even in the first week. It is an extraordinary legacy, and well, I think we've all been watching the Chicago Bulls documentary on Netflix about their 6 NBA titles. I was going to say world titles, but I mean, it's not a world title, is it? It's just an American title. Sorry. They call it a world title. Again, though, setting their own terms of reference, the similarity there. But it's, you know, the run of Tour de France victories, how will it be looked at in, say, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years' time? I mean, it's interesting that they've basically been undefeated when they've, you know, except for a crash, really, for so long with different riders.
Yeah. And when you think back to, you know, Cadel Evans winning in 2011, does seem like a long, long time ago. And that was really the last tour before the start of this run. The Last Dance, there's the series you mentioned on Netflix. And watching that is interesting, because they talk in that about, you know, is this one of the greatest ever sporting teams? And there's a lot of contemporary footage from there. I've also been watching, you know, the Drive to Survive series about Formula One, and you know, you've got similar questions asked there about Lewis Hamilton, you know, is he the greatest ever, and so on. And what's interesting about watching these documentary series on other sports is that the questions that are being asked are not the same. The atmosphere is not the same as it has been in cycling for the last 15 years, where the big question has been, can we believe what we're seeing? And there's none of that scepticism at all in the Last Dance, and there's certainly none of that either in the Formula One series. You know, that's not that there aren't questions about underhand practices or shortcuts or, you know, all kinds of nefarious goings-ons, but in cycling, the dominant question and the existential question is, can we believe what we're seeing? And that has kind of overwhelmed everything, all the debate and all the discussion around the sport over the last 15 or so years, I think. You know, that's the big difference I see.
Yeah, I think you're right, Richard. Maybe therein lies this, well, I talked about this bridge that they will or won't build between admiration and affection. I think they've gained the admiration, certainly among those who you know, don't cast doubt on their performances. They've certainly gained a lot of admiration, but not necessarily affection. But maybe that is also to do with, you know, faith and confidence in how things are being achieved.
Hey guys, it's April 24th, back here in lockdown with Larry. today did the third stage of the Digital Swiss 5, so the virtual Tour de Suisse, and it ended up going pretty well. So I finished third, which was pretty cool, because I took it pretty seriously, you know, which I think a lot of guys did, but then some guys, I'm sure, definitely did not. So it was interesting to see the mix of motivation of guys. But yeah, it was probably one of the hardest hours of my life. I suffered really, really hard out there today. So that was pretty funny, because I think I was more nervous for this race this morning than I am for an actual classic sometimes. So, you know, it's like the racing we do usually, we're so accustomed to it, and, you know, we race so many days a year. You know, for a lot of us, around 80 days a year is pretty normal. So it ends up kind of being like just another day at work when you show up to the start line of a lot of these races. And I didn't really know what to expect with this digital race. And, you know, yesterday was my first time using Ruvi, the application that it was run on. So I was a little bit, you know, apprehensive and a bit nervous about it. And it was kind of funny. Felt like a junior again. But I tried to, you know, take it pretty seriously, and I thought about everything in terms of like cooling and fueling and everything like that. So I think I probably had an advantage on some of the other guys because, you know, I could open the windows and it was really cold outside, and I put a fan in the window to blow like the cold air on me. And I actually raced with like 5 fans on me. So I probably had the best cooling system out of any of the guys. So that was probably a pretty big advantage. But it was still super hard. I didn't really know what the pacing strategy would be because unlike Zwift or some of the other apps, there's no drafting in Ruvi. So it works out to be pretty much like a time trial, but you just have a lot of carrots around you. So that was actually really motivating, having all the other guys around me to chase. And, you know, then for a while I got locked in a battle there with Kwiatkowski and Zakarin, and it was pretty funny. So, you know, I could see that I had a different pacing strategy to Kwiatkowski. So there was a lot of times where I'd gain 10 meters, he'd catch me, he'd pass me, gain 10 meters, then I'd blow by him again. And so yeah, it was a pretty good laugh. And then one of my teammates, Roman Bardet, he was supposed to race and have the camera on him, and at the last minute he found out his internet wasn't good enough, so I ended up with the camera, which I think also made for some funny images because I definitely was suffering. So I guess everyone got to watch me suffer like I've been enjoying watching them. So all in all, a good day, and I'm pretty happy with the performance, but one day was enough. I couldn't imagine suffering that hard that many times in a week. So pretty happy about that, and I'm happy to watch it for the next 2 days rather than join in. I guess just an interesting note on racing on the trainer and stuff like that. So I think before, a lot of us sort of were under the impression that like, oh, we can't train on the trainer. Oh, it's too hard. Oh, you know, it's like you can't do the same watts on the trainer as you can outside. And I think people are starting to realize that with like today's trainers and all these training apps, actually, like you can train really efficiently and really hard. And in the end, you can probably go at least as hard or even do more power on the trainer because, you know, it's not like there's switchbacks or things where you have to stop pedaling and stuff like that. So, you know, I think you definitely get a more efficient workout when you're doing the workout. But then in the race, it's like it makes it even harder because there's just absolutely no respite. You know, there's nowhere where you can stop pedaling or lull or something because like all of a sudden then you get caught off the back. And so, yeah, it makes you end up, in a pretty dark place at the end of today. So actually, the other thing I forgot to mention was another thing that I had was my coach was pretty into it, and he had me download this app, which is sort of like walkie-talkies a bit on the phone. And so he was actually coaching me through, talking in my ear the whole time. And I'm 90% sure I would have been the only rider having that as well. So it was pretty interesting and pretty funny. And one thing we definitely don't take into consideration, and it's funny because I wrote this to my coach and then I later saw Vauders tweeted something similar, but like we thought Remco was going to smash everyone. You know, ends up getting 7th. Okay, who knows if he was going like as hard as it can go, but I'm assuming if you're still top 10, you gave it a really good effort, you know, because like this is not slacking here. There's a lot of good guys and, you know, at least 10 guys are trying super hard. And, you know, made me wonder about his aerodynamics because he is super compact and powerful. And then, yeah, obviously you see that on the TT. I think he was 2nd in the Worlds last year. But, you know, I think one thing people take for granted is that makes a big difference in a road race. And when I think about, you know, some of the guys we race with. Like today, I just watched the documentary on Tour of Flanders from 2018, and I noticed like Nicky Terpstra, you know, he's super strong on the flat, but I also noticed he has a super aero position. It makes me think about some other guys like my old teammate Adam Blythe had a super aero position, and anytime we do a race, he did so many less watts than us, and we thought like, oh, that's just because he's super good in the bunch. But like now I'm starting to think back on all these things and how like, you know, I actually think aerodynamics on a road bike makes a gigantic difference, and a lot more than most people think. So I think that's definitely one really big factor that we don't really take into account. And, you know, maybe some of us are just a lot less aero than others. And I think that might be somewhere where we might see a lot more time invested, because like, okay, people are thinking about aero bikes now, but people, I mean, some people are, but like not that many people are testing their road positions in like the wind tunnel or on the track and stuff like that. And I'm thinking that like that's going to be actually really big in the future should we get to race on the road again. It's just something that I've been thinking about, so thought I'd share it with you guys. And yeah, we'll look forward to watching the next couple of days of the Digital Swiss 5 and not have to do it again for the near future. Have a good one, guys.
Hey guys, it's April 27th now, just about to go to bed, and yeah, I just listened to last week's cycling podcast, so kind of funny to just, you know, listen in and see the progression that's happened in the last week, but yeah, I guess not too much going on here. Kind of funny because I did a ramp test on Zwift today, which normally is an effort that I detest because, you know, you have to suffer, they're really hard, whatever, but it was pretty funny today because compared to the hour and 13 minutes of pain of the Digital Swiss, it actually felt so much easier, because this was only like 20 minutes long. So I think maybe this virtual racing thing can change our mindset towards suffering for races in the future. So maybe just every time you need to train the suffering and train the ability to go super deep, you just need to do an hour long race on the home trainer, and it'll probably get you ready. So I thought that was kind of a funny observation. And another funny thing was After that Digital Swiss stage that I did, I went so deep that actually like that night I couldn't even sleep. I think that was maybe the hardest, the deepest I've ever gone on the bike, maybe ever or close to it. And I also found it funny because I don't think I'm the only one, since I watched a little interview with Nico Roche. And he said that, you know, he would never be able to go that hard on in a normal race because you actually have to ride in a straight line and there's other people around you and you have to keep your bike on the road. And he said, you know, in this, you're essentially just in your living room. So if you fall over, it doesn't matter. So yeah, it's actually it's a pretty funny comment. And he told me the day that I did it, he almost fainted at the end. So at least that made me feel a little bit better about myself. So yeah, it was some good laughs with that. And, you know, I've kind of gotten really even more interested in all this stuff. So I started Googling, you know, the best fans to buy for indoor racing. And yeah, all these people were recommending like these industrial blower fans. So I ordered one online, and like it's just this like super insane, crazy fan made for like workshops and barns and stuff like that. And apparently it blows the wind so fast that you have to wear glasses, otherwise your eyes get dried out. So that'll be a great addition to the pain cave, and kind of funny. So I'm looking forward to that coming. And yeah, I think also I'm just like, you know, getting bored, cooped up inside and wanting to find cool things to buy So I'm going to have pretty much the most decked out pain cave by the end of this lockdown. Yeah, that's my update from the last few days. Beyond that, not a whole lot's changed, just going through the motions. So I hope you all are well and talk to you soon.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. You can still get 25% off all your Science and Sport products with the code SISCP25 at the checkout at scienceandsport.com. Now, launching this week, Science and Sport's new Go Energy Bakes. These are basically just cakes that you can take on the bike with you. And one of these items saved me a couple of weeks ago while I was on my turbo trainer. And starting to get that kind of lightheadedness that you get sometimes when you know that you're running on empty, and it really did save me. I've got the lemon and the strawberry flavor. I've got four boxes of these things, and I believe I was supposed to share them with you, Lionel, but unfortunately,
well, I was going to ask, what's happened here?
In quotes,
in
the current circumstances, it's obviously extremely difficult to get these to you.
It's so really not, though, is it? Because the Royal Mail is still delivering, Richard.
Yeah, but I just thought it was better to err on the side of caution and keep them here. and they've been nice with my morning coffee, a tasty snack. So,
You've been working hard to earn the cake rather than just eating.
You know what?
Snack.
I might actually just go and grab one now. I'm quite peckish. Hang on. You guys chat among yourselves. We heard from Larry Warbass there just before the break. Some quite interesting observations from Larry there about, competing in the digital, what do we call it? Digital Swiss race.
The Digital Swiss.
Correct.
Yeah.
Erroneously referred to, I noticed at the weekend in numerous places, as the Digital Tour de Suisse or Tour of Switzerland. There might be another Tour de Suisse. Ah. I understand that that's something that could be in the works.
Anyway, while I grab my energy bake, Lionel, can you give us a sort of coronavirus news update?
Well, I can, yeah. There's a provisional cycling calendar that has been floating around, kicking off on August the 1st with Strada Bianca, and then Milan-San Remo a week later, and then a four-day edition of the Dauphiné before the National Championships, and then the Tour de France starting on August the 29th, and really cramming everything in between the 1st of August and the end of November. Now, we're not going to debate the likelihood of this calendar being possible, but it just goes without saying, really, that everybody in cycling has an opinion on what is possible, what is probable. There's some people saying that the Grand Tour should be cut down from 3 weeks to 2 weeks in order to squeeze them all in. Alejandro Valverde made that case, for example. Other people dubious that anything will be held this year, and I think our line is still, my line certainly is still, let's see what gets scheduled and when it gets scheduled. Some riders have been expressing concerns about the lack of anti-doping tests, Romain Bardet and Victor Campenaerts among them. That's going to become more of an issue as we get closer to some sort of racing resuming, of course. And there are positive signs that we are moving in that direction. Perhaps Italian riders will be allowed to train outdoors from May the 4th. Or Italian-based riders, rather.
You moved there very swiftly from doping tests to positive signs, Lionel.
That wasn't deliberate. I mean, that was just the words that came out of the hole in my face. Sorry about that. No pun intended. In France, riders will be able to ride outdoors from May the 11th. Colombian riders are being given a special dispensation to ride outdoors as long as they go early in the morning. So the rules are different for everyone depending on where they are in the world. And that will have an impact as well when it comes down to deciding who is fit and ready to race. the Digital Swiss race that you mentioned, Richard, was broadcast. I watched some of it online. Rowan Dennis won stages 1 and 5. Stephen Kung won stages 2 and 4. And Nicola Roach won stage 3. I don't know whether either of you caught any of it. It was, it's digital riders, digital avatars, but with a real backdrop. And certainly as a TV spectacle, it was easier on the eye, perhaps, than the virtual Tour of Flanders that we watched a couple of weeks ago. That was my opinion anyway. What did you make of it?
Yes, Lionel, I think at the moment, all of the digital platforms having to work very smartly and very fast to try and get things ready for, well, the opportunities that are available to them at the moment, with all these pro races, all these pro teams wanting to race. And the Ruby platform is an interesting one with the real sort of road footage. But I guess that it will get better with every race that takes place on that platform. So as I said, I think there are other things in the works involving World Tour teams, Velon teams. I don't think any of us dispute that the riders are taking them seriously and riding very hard. I think I've heard a few things in private from riders, not about the Ruby platform, but not specifically about that, but about some of the other events, that they've questioned at times whether people are putting their weight in properly, and some of the results have looked a bit wonky. But hopefully we put that down to teething problems.
Well, I mean, this is inevitable at the moment, isn't it? I mean, I think we should just kind of park it as it's entertainment, it's exhibition racing. It's not a replacement for the sport in this, in this format, in, you know, the long term. And hopefully it won't need to be. But that doesn't mean you can't watch it as a form of entertainment. But taking it seriously as a sporting endeavour would require, you know, everyone to be on the same setup. And, you know, from hearing from riders, you know, there are disparities between different types of turbo trainer. We don't know whether the figures that come through, you know, think of all of I'm showing my lack of expertise here, so I'll be a little bit careful, but the converting the power that goes through the pedals into the numbers that are being converted in the game aspect, I mean, that has to be uniform across everyone taking part in order for it to be treated as a sporting event, I think. I suppose the one thing about the Digital Swiss race was, and we're so hardwired watching cycling and riding bikes out on the road ourselves, but we're suddenly seeing a car coming down the road towards Rowan Dennis on stage 1 was a bit of a, you know, eye-opening moment, and I had to sort of check myself and realise that.
I mean, they shouldn't be letting cars on there, should they?
Well, I know. Who was in charge of the road closures? It's like the no, I'm not.
Well, it's good. If the race had been taking place in Girona, it could have been Rowan Dennis in the car.
Based on
activity.
And as well, I mean, you know, we've joked about it, but it is a factor. You know, somebody's Wi-Fi drops out and they're out of the race, aren't they? I mean, that's just how it is. I mean, I suppose
that's equivalent of a puncture, isn't it?
At least you can get back on. If you've got to reinsert the Wi-Fi code to get fired up again.
Stick your hand up and an engineer runs in instead of a mechanic.
In real cycling, Remco Evenepoel rode the Mur in Hedersbergen 50 times on Monday. He'd announced he was going to do it and then was worried that people would join him or try and ride with him or want photos with him or whatever. So he said he wasn't going to do it and then actually did do it secretly. So 50 climbs of the Mur, that's a lot of cycling, isn't it? A lot of uphill cycling. I'm not sure how many meters gained that would be. Was it an Everest attempt? I'm not sure.
I don't think Everest, no. I mean, I rode up the Paterberg the other day on the RGT platform that we mentioned at the start. That was quite hard. Very hard,
was it,
in fact.
Was it bumpy? Did you have any cobbly?
No. I mean, my trainer doesn't have that facility, so it was a very smooth. I found the smoothest line on the Paterberg, put it that way.
Oh, right, yeah. You're in the little gully on the left hand side.
I was in the gully. Yeah. I mean,
you've got to be careful there.
You've got to be really careful. You've got to steer in a very straight line, which I managed.
So, well done. And the UCI sent out a press release earlier this week saying that the UCI, the world governing body, of course, has joined the movement for climate action that's been initiated by the United Nations. And this is really an attempt for cycling to position itself as one of the most environmentally friendly sports. Now, before the coronavirus crisis, I was actually working quite hard on putting together an episode of perhaps a Kilometre Zero about cycling and the climate. It was a response really to the severe bushfires that we saw in Australia. And I spoke to a number of climate scientists and got various different opinions about, you know, cycling's impact on the environment, but also the likely impact of the environment on cycling with increasing temperatures in the European summer and perhaps the bigger threat to an event like the Tour de France being temperatures and particularly humidity reaching levels that become dangerous for the athletes. And a couple of people even sort of hypothesized about the idea that in the future, you know, the Tour de France stages might have to be held earlier in the day so that the heat is not so extreme. But we haven't really got a slot to play that feature at the moment. And there are a couple of people that I'd like to talk to about the impact that the coronavirus crisis has had on the environment, and perhaps there'll be some early signs of whether things like air quality have improved as a result of a reduction in human activity. So I'm going to kind of keep working on that, and we'll put it out a bit later on in the year. But it was interesting to see that the UCI is going to be undertaking efforts to promote greater environmental responsibility, reducing the overall climate impact of the sport, and educating people on the impact that unsustainable or less sustainable consumption can have on the climate. So we'll revisit that perhaps once this current crisis is easing a bit. Finally, Richard, the next episode of the Cycling Podcast Feminine will be out when?
It will be out on Friday.
On Friday,
yeah. And
now,
yeah.
Well, I was just going to mention the Bigler Katusha team is experiencing some difficulties at the moment, and I was going to ask whether you were going to cover that in this week's episode of the Cycling Podcast Feminine.
And I was going to anticipate you asking that question, Lionel, and say yes, we will hear from Lizzie Banks on that in this week's episode. Lizzie obviously presents Service Course for us. A new episode of that came out last week. She also rides for Bigla Katusha, so we'll hear from her on that. The episode, actually, Cycling Podcast Femina, will be devoted to Annemiek van Vleuten. We'll hear from her coach, Louis Delahaye, and from Annemiek van Vleuten herself as well, kind of looking at how she became the world's best female rider. So that will be out on Friday. Shall we hear part two of my interview with Dave Brailsford, where I ask him some questions about how he and the team are managing things during this current crisis? Here is Dave Brailsford again.
It's been an interesting period, actually, because obviously, you know, any sports team set up to give value to their owners by competing, and in our case, racing, and that's where the value comes. So I think quite early on, we decided to try and create sort of three phases of this. One was the into lockdown and a transition into lockdown, and then once we were in lockdown, which we're currently in, you know, this lockdown block, as it were. Then we got to transition out of lockdown and get training again and back into, well, whatever normal training will look like, and then finally we go into before we go back into racing. So I think by thinking about it in that sense, I think in the first instance we're pretty as everybody transitioned into this kind of lockdown phase, I thought it was important just take our time, let people get used to it, let people adapt before we started to, you know, push on training or push on anything else really. So we took maybe a week or so to let people settle into it. But in the meantime, we started to think very carefully about, you know, how can we create value? What can we do? Because we can't race, so what else can we do for our owners and sponsors and partners? and that's where we started to think about, well, how can we use our social platforms? How can we use our the extent of our reach or voice and media and other opportunities and also help in other areas. And I think that's where the opportunity to help on this kind of project with INEOS directly on their hand sanitizer project came about. So coming back to the original question, I think we kind of managed the whole thing by letting everybody settle down first, making sure everybody was okay, making sure they got all the kit and everything they needed to be able to train, and then set out a bit of a roadmap in terms of, okay, chunking it up into smaller phases or chunks where we could all get aligned and think about it in a similar way. So we went into this kind of lockdown phase. There was a point at which it was like, okay, guys, we've got to work. You know, we're not here to spend time. You know, we're still getting paid. You know, it isn't a break. It isn't a holiday. We've got to work. And that means, you know, to be fair to the guys, their work ethic on the bike is phenomenal anyway. So they're quite happy to crack on and still maintain their form and train and work hard. But equally for the staff team, you know, it's an opportunity to say, okay, well, what are we going to work on and how are we going to work productively so that when we can come back to racing, we're going to be as well set as anybody to take that on.
That's kind of how I approached it, really. Yeah, I mean, there's a perception that might or might not be fair that INEOS would be one of the more stable sponsors in cycling. And there's obviously a great deal of uncertainty around some of the other teams. Are you concerned about the sort of precariousness of the sport and the model that the sport has?
I think when something of this magnitude comes along, it doesn't just impact sport, it's impacted everybody in society, hasn't it? You know, so it's such a big change. I mean, it's such a big crisis, I guess, it's inevitably going to hit everybody's core businesses, as it were, and then you know, flow out from there. And if you're in a sport such as ours, which is 100% dependent on its income from sponsors, we've got no ticketing, we've got no facilities, we haven't got any TV rights worth talking about. You know, our income comes from sponsors, and if sponsors' businesses come under threat, then the sponsorship side of their operation is one of the first things, unfortunately, that they could trim. Whilst focusing on maintaining their core business and keeping a business alive. So it does put us as a, you know, everybody within the whole sport is in a precarious situation when you take it in that context, really, which does make it fragile. There's no doubt about it. And I don't think anybody's beyond that.
I mean, I saw you quoted last week saying that, you know, you would be keeping an open mind on the Tour de France and whether it could go ahead in late August. None of us know, of course, whether that will be possible or not, but are you aware of, or you talked about sort of opportunities to maybe change things a little bit, are you aware of the sort of major stakeholders in cycling, UCI, RCS, ASO obviously, talking to each other about how they might manage bike racing? Because obviously the crowd aspect is one aspect, the safety of the riders is another. But it strikes me that, that cycle racing could be, might not lose so much from not having a crowd as, say, a football match, for example. And so perhaps closed circuits or some other kind of imaginative way of holding bike racing could be realised at some point. Do you think people are thinking like that at all?
Yeah, I think they are, Rich, to be honest. I think at the minute, most people in the sort of sporting community, regardless of what sport it is, everybody's sort of what's taxing their minds is how do we go from lockdown back into normal training before competition? So you've got the actual what's competition going to look like, but there's this first phase, if you like, of coming out of lockdown and how do we start training again and what does that look like? And there's a lot of dialogue actually between, you know, amongst sort of the sports medics and the sort of logistics and organisers in terms of, well, how are we going to make sure that social distancing is safe, or it's safe for the players, safe for the staff, and of course safe for, in whatever context, for people to watch or for fans. And there's a lot of work and communication going on in and around that at the minute. Then you come to, well, what form does racing or competition have to take in order for it to be safe enough to be allowed. And I think just going the basic idea of thinking, well, let's just do what's previously been done and go back to that, and let's try and get back to normal, is probably the wrong way to think about it. I think it's probably a case of, okay, what are the limitations? What are the constraints? And how can we take what we want to achieve and apply it with those limitations and constraints? And that might have to come up with, you know, we might end up with new scenarios or new solutions or new ways of doing things. But I think that's the situation we're in. So I think we've just got to be flexible with that and very open-minded. And there is a lot of dialogue going on. And I think people are being pretty creative and pretty reasonable, I think. Mm. Would be my take on it.
Lionel's suggestion of a grand tour consisting only of time trials is perhaps not the most attractive option. But
yeah.
But I'm thinking of, you know, like a Hammer series type format, you know, on closed circuits. That could be something that perhaps could have its day. Not permanently, but just as a temporary measure.
No, and I think it's a bit like, you know, people are creative, I think, and they adapt. And they adapt what they can do to the situation they're in. And I think even in this lockdown phase, you know, we've, I think a lot of people have maybe rethought how they perceive e-racing and, you know, how they saw it maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago and how they see it now might be quite different, because I think people have adapted and what people have creatively managed to put on as racing has been, I think, been brilliant. And I think we'll see the same. So I think people will try and start off with a, can we have a grand tour? And if you can't have a grand tour like you used to have a grand tour, then what version of a grand tour can you have? And I think you keep on going until you get something that's workable.
And I mean, Dave, you mentioned that, you know, that the riders have you know, are obviously very driven and will carry on working hard. But I guess some will be reacting to this differently than others. Egan Bernal is a guy, isn't he, who likes to ride very long miles on the road. Rowan Dennis is somebody who I thought probably more suited to the, you know, the turbo trainer and the watts and all the rest of it, although he seemed to crack last weekend. But psychologically it's a challenge, isn't it, not for the riders and also for the staff.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. Things are very, very different at the minute, and I think there's, for all of us, the high degree of uncertainty plays into that challenge. And, you know, people are individual. We're all individuals. We all think independently, and we're all in very different situations at the minute, depending where you are in the world and, you know, your home scenario. And so I think trying to think of it just as a group, as an overall, there's a one-size-fits-all solution to this, and this is what we should do, is okay in general, but really I think you've got to accept everybody's individual and have individual responses, and you've got to work with that, and you've got to accept that, you know, and work with people, I think, and support them where necessary and encourage them where necessary. And and I think the real solution, from somebody in my position, when you're thinking about leadership or you're thinking about managing a group or supporting a group, and that's including staff and riders, think pretty carefully, I think, in terms of what do people need from you at this moment in time, and what can you give, you know, people to help them manage with the situation, stay motivated, and I still think have ambition. You know, I think it's very easy in these situations where everything's challenging to think, oh, blimey, you know, we just need to, you can get dampened down with your enthusiasm and ambition. But the sun is going to come out, you know, and we are going to be back into better days, and things are going to get better and brighter. And I think, you know, I'd like to sort of encourage the guys to think, don't let this situation dim your enthusiasm, your ambition, you know, your excitement, because that day is coming. It is all coming back. And when it does come back, be ready for it, you know. So build towards something. Don't let the pressure of the situation weigh too much on your shoulders, you know.
And just finally, Dave, I mean, there's other stuff, transfers, you know, some riders out, transfer at the end of the year, you'll have been looking at riders to bring in. Does that carry on? Is that more or less business as usual, or is that on pause as well?
No, it's been ongoing, but I think there's a lot of uncertainty because, you know, the harsh reality is, I think, you know, there's questions about, I think the whole market is a little bit poised because, you know, let's talk about certain teams being more difficult than the others, and maybe certain riders becoming available from different teams. And, you know, obviously there's a timing perspective in terms of within your own team, looking at your own financial structure and future, and where do you stand with that, and what ability do you have to invest at the minute, as against waiting, and just making sure that you know what's coming, you know, how the season might pan out. You know, are we going to race again this year? We're not going to race again this year. What impact would that have? So I do think on the financial side and the recruitment side, there's a lot of unknowns in there. Mm. And some people are trying to, you know, lock down, I think, and other people are trying to sort of think, okay, well, are there any opportunities out there as in any other market, you know?
Well, that was Dave Brailsford, principal at Team Ineos, and I asked him there about whether he was aware of conversations happening among the major stakeholders, I suppose, in terms of organising cycling, the UCI, ASO, RCS, for example, about, you know, how racing might return, because the provisional calendar that we have just sort of shifts everything back a few months. And we imagine at the moment, and we don't have any way of knowing whether this is feasible or not, that we will have, you know, Paris-Roubaix in the form that we know it. The Tour of Flanders in the form we know it. The Tour de France in the form we know it. And I'm wondering whether there are some conversations being had about contingency plans whereby a kind of new form of bike racing is imagined on closed circuits with much tighter crowd control, but also safeguards in place to protect the riders. I mean, Mike Woods touched on it last week in the cycling podcast about the possible dangers for the riders themselves of contracting coronavirus. And actually, Fred Grapp, the coach at Groupama FDJ, has posted today a blog from the British Journal of Sports Science about how coronavirus might have very adverse effects on athletes as they return to competition. And, you know, I don't know, I mean, something like the Hammer Series, for example, you know, that kind of concept of racing where races are held on small circuits and in much more manageable environments might be a way back for bike racing if bike racing in the form that we know it and love it proves in the short term not possible.
Well, I noticed, Richard, that Dave Brailsford laughed at my suggestion of a grand tour made up of time trials, but I mean, that would be taking the sport right back to its roots, wouldn't it? Why not? I mean, I can't believe I'm even suggesting this, really, but these are extraordinary times.
Also, chaps, maybe more seriously, we've been looking at old Giri d'Italia, and we've been noticing the great preponderance of Italian riders and Italian teams in previous editions, and maybe a return to more sort of localized or domestic cycling. Maybe, you know, the majority of races in a given country being contested by teams and riders from those countries, and then, you know, the whole sort of cycling international family coming together only three or four times maybe a year for the Tour de France, World Championships, and a few other big races.
You know, I would settle for something, some kind of compromise. The problem that cycling has is that it's so divided, and other sports where there's a kind of, you know, Formula One or something, where there's a clear kind of owner. I know there's a governing body and an owner there, but cycling seems particularly divided in terms of how it's run. And you would hope that at some level that there are conversations at least happening about how, you know, you could have a Belgian Tour of Flanders, and I would certainly watch that, and it would be great, and not as a replacement for what we've grown used to, but as a short term replacement, that would be great. The Hammer Series, I mentioned that. I mean, you know, something like that, perhaps.
But how do you stop people turning out to watch something if it's being held somewhere public? I mean, just going back to Remco Evenepoel riding the Mur, just to correct myself and add a bit of info, he'd actually announced he was going to ride it 10 times by bike, but ended up riding it 50 times. It took him 8 hours and was 216 kilometres, and it wasn't the height of Everest. It was 5,145 vertical metres, according to Laster News. But I was just reading that and thinking, you know, a circuit race on the Mur, for example, would be controllable in one sense for the athletes and the people working around the race, but anything that's held on public roads is going to attract a crowd. How would you keep people away? Well, little boxes on the roadside and only one person allowed in each box? I don't know.
I would think that you know, I'm talking about imagining this with social distancing still in place, and if that's the law, then that's the law. And I think also that people, that the vast majority of people are going to be very reluctant to gather in crowds, and so I think that that's one very strong kind of lesson from this, that people, if given enough of a fright, as I think a lot of people have been with this, that they're going to be very reluctant to come together in crowds anytime soon. And certainly while there's still a danger and a threat, yeah, I think that it would need policing, but it perhaps might not need as much policing as we imagine.
What about bike races on motor racing circuits? I mean, that would be one way to keep crowds out, oddly. And there is a sort of history and legacy of races. The Worlds have been held on the Nürburgring and at Zolder in Belgium. The Giro finished a couple of years with a couple of laps of the circuit at Imola, didn't it? I remember the Tour finishing at the Spa Francorchamps circuit in 1989. I mean, maybe that's an alternative or an option, that you could have much more controllable environments for circuit races. And as we're easing back in, that might be actually more realistic than saying we're going to hold the Tour de France and the Amstel Gold Race and the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix and so on. But we haven't really reached that point yet in the realization of how the world is going to emerge from this crisis, I guess.
Well, there are options, aren't there, and they're worth looking at, and you hope that discussions are happening about what they might be. Anything else before we go this week, chaps?
Well, Rich, there have been other periods in cycling history when there have been severe restrictions placed on who can race where. Certainly for riders in the former Eastern Bloc countries before the fall of the Berlin Wall, most of our listeners will be familiar with the Peace Race, or they'll have heard of the Peace Race, which was the old tour of the Eastern Bloc countries, or Germany, Poland and the Czech Republic. Used to be the Tour de France, the equivalent of the Tour de France in those countries, the most prestigious bike race there was in those countries. This year it is the 50th anniversary of a famous edition of the Peace Race, the 1970 edition, famous because it was the first of three victories for the Polish rider Richard Sikorski. Richard Sikorski, who unfortunately over the past 3 years has been having a very hard time. Earlier this week, I spoke to a real expert on the Peace Race, Herbie Sykes, our colleague who lives in Italy, about Sikorski, about that 1970 edition of the Peace Race and why it's important.
So in cycling, we often talk about, we often debate the greatest of them all. It's a classic cycling trope, I suppose. And it usually centres around Eddy Merckx, Fausto Coppi and Bernard Hinault. And sometimes, I guess, there's a nod to Anke Thiel and Binder and so on. And cycling loves to glorify its past. And cycling is kind of indivisible from and rooted in its landscape, and I think it's probably, there's only really skiing which is similar in that respect, but both of those sports are quintessentially European. So whilst the Americas, for example, might conceive great cyclists, it's always Europe which manufactures them. But Europe was obviously split in two after the Second World War, and professional sport is a capitalist construct, and it didn't exist on the other side of the Berlin Wall. There was no such thing, and so paradoxically, however, the Soviet bloc riders were far more professional than Western European riders, because sport was a geopolitical construct over there. They used it to demonstrate communism's moral and ideological supremacy. It was very important to them to be successful at the World Championships and the Olympics, and they invested heavily in that. It was a big geopolitical instrument for them. And in a cycling context, that meant that there was a kind of a parallel stage racing circuit. And I think at the centerpiece of that was the peace race, the Berlin Warsaw Prague peace race that was created in 1949. It's no accident that it started each year on VE Day, because it traversed this war-torn continent of ours. But its riders weren't sponsored; they were literally couriers of an idea, and the idea was peace. The peace race was much less formulaic than the Giro and the Tour, and I think most people would agree more dramatic as a consequence. And millions of people watched it because you had to watch it. You had a civic duty to watch it, go out and watch the stages. So, in essence, it was the highlight of the sporting year in those countries, and it goes without saying that the riders were superstars. Cycling was no less popular on the other side of the Berlin Wall because obviously people rode bikes there just as they rode them here. So when we talk about the greatest of all time, and we refer to Coppi and Hinault and Merckx, so do they, but their greatest of all time are a different set of riders that probably didn't really resonate in the West because we didn't actually know much about it. It was a parallel world, as I said. 50 years ago, almost to the day, Richard Szorkowski, who was 24 at the time, began his second peace race and ultimately won it. And he went on to win three more. In 1973, he famously won the World Championship road race, the amateur road race, because obviously professional sport didn't exist in Poland. And he did all this in an very interesting moment in Polish time, and specifically, It was a period of unparalleled success for Poland's footballers. It was geopolitically, it was quite a big moment, but also in a sporting context. You've got these great footballers that everybody knows about, these legends that almost won the World Cup and almost won the European Championship. And yet Szorkowski, a cyclist, was his country's Sportsman of the Year twice. He also got a UNESCO International Fair Play Award, and in essence, his palmares is unparalleled in the history of amateur cycling. When we think of Coppi and Bartali in Italy or Anquetil and Poulidor in France, Szorkowski and Szosta was a Polish equivalent of that, if you like. It was felt every bit as keenly as those. As I say, this stuff never really resonated in the West, but that doesn't alter the fact that Szorkowski was a truly great racing cyclist. And that explains actually a kind of a curio of cycling history. In 1974, they invited a Polish national team to Paris-Nice because everybody wanted to see Szorkowski ride against Merckx. He actually podiumed at three of the stages, but politically it was complex. The Western trade teams hated the idea that Polish amateurs could be invited to race. Szorkowski, though, was a racer, and that's how he defined himself, and that's how he was defined, and he never stopped racing his bike. He became an important figure in Polish cycling, in the Polish Cycling Federation, but he always rode, and in 2018 he took part in an amateur Tour of Cologne, the old Tour of Cologne. They reinvented it as an amateur race. By then he was 72, and to cut a long story short, he was involved in a terrible, terrible crash, which left him paralyzed. And Szorkowski's rehabilitation is long. It's going to be long, and it's slow, and it's painful, and it's painful for everybody that understood who he was and what he meant. The thing with Szorkowski is that aside from being a great champion, which he undoubtedly was, he's also a great human being. And so a friend of mine, a Polish friend of mine, Lukasz Toszynski, got in touch and asked if there's something that I could do. The Lions Club in Poland, in Poznan, are trying to raise some money for a special vehicle so that Richard can get about, get to and from his rehab, and but obviously that's an expensive process. And so I've taken it upon myself, with their blessing, to open a Just Giving page, and this is kind of an appeal to anybody that loves cycling and loves cyclists to try and help in some way, if at all possible. You just go to Just Giving and go to crowdfund justgiving.com/crowdfunding/HerbieSykes. and you'll see that there's a page and people can make donations to help Richard through this terrible time. So, I mean, anything that anybody could give, any help is gratefully received. And as I say, this guy was a super champion. So thanks in advance. And as I say, anything at all, we'd be really grateful to have.
So that was the very sad story about Richard Sikorski. And as Herbie said there, you can donate to the appeal that's been set up by the Lions Club in Poznań on Herbie's Just Giving page. So that is justgiving.com/crowdfunding/Herbie Sykes. Herbie spelled H-E-R-B-I-E Sykes, S-Y-K-E-S. Another footnote to that story, Rich. Richard Sikorski's son, Norbert Sikorski, actually died in the 9/11 attacks on the Twin Towers in New York. He was, I think he was decorating, he was only 31 years old, he was decorating in one of the Twin Towers for Cantor Fitzgerald, I think it was a law company, and he would usually have been leaving the Twin Towers at about the time when the first plane struck, and he sadly died.
That's terrible. I mean, we'll put details of how to contribute to Herbie's fund in the episode notes for this week's episode. But if any of you feel like you can contribute, then please do. It's a great cause. That's all for this week then, isn't it? And we'll be back next week with our Giro preview episode. Lots in that, and we'll tell you a bit more about how we're going to cover our Giro.
One more thing, Rich. The last couple of Sunday mornings, we've been doing our meetup rides on Zwift, haven't we? A couple of Sundays ago, we did a couple of laps of Central Park in virtual New York. And then on Sunday, we rode the Innsbruck 2018 World Championship course. We're riding again this Sunday. We've made it open to friends of the podcast. All 100 places have been allocated already. So I think you have to be pretty quick off the mark to join the meetup ride. If you've not managed to get a place in the ride, we do have our Giro coming up, which will be on the RGT platform, which is currently free for people to use. So stand by for details of how to join us on one of those stages. We'll reveal all in next week's podcast.
Before we go, some thank yous to friends of the podcast, and we should have a very special announcement next week as well for a special treat for friends of the podcast. So do tune in for that. That's a special treat in addition to the interview, the hard-hitting interview with Daniel Freeb, which will be released next week. First in a series of us interviewing each other. And, this one is contains several bombshells. Worth the subscription alone, I would think. Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. And among those who already have, a big thank you to Angus Barber, Tristan Price, Dara Larkin, Mark Finlay, Robert Osborne, John Cowie, Dan Naylor, Luke Smith, Mark Middleton, and Mark Weaver.
And a big thank you to Adam Gray, Alan Burns, David Butcher, Richard Freeman. Not that Richard Freeman.
No, it's a different Richard Freeman.
Thank you very much, Richard. Paul Farmer, Craig Moyer, David Cattrall, Neil Hodgson, Mark Carter, and Gary Sibbett.
And thanks to David Phillips, Alex Caraffi, Dan Jones, Dan Reese, Joachim Define, Andrew Crichton, Helen Curtis, Chad Marshall, and Hugh Perkins. You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.